Chapter 8. Security. Introduction. Quote, "Security is the primary consideration for an underground and permeates the entire movement, its organizational structure, members, and activities, and is a prerequisite for the movement's survival." End quote. The Underground, ST-31-202, dated August 16, 1978. Through the establishment and enforcement of security measures, an underground is able to ensure its ability to provide administrative and operational support to the insurgency as it evolves during the early stages of growth and activities. This chapter highlights key concepts of security that have been adopted by previous revolutionary movements and also provides examples of breaches in these security measures and the resultant consequences for the associated insurgency. Formation and organization of the underground. From the initial steps of an insurgency forming, the core leadership of the movement must consider basic issues of secrecy and security for the members. Trust, a common cause, and often existing personal relationships provide a preliminary ad hoc security screen for the core leadership, but as soon as steps are taken to activate the movement and reach out to potential donors or new recruits, a much more rigorous and standardized security policy must be in place. Even in the absence of having previous experience with insurgencies, as is common among new insurgent leaders, leaders of a new movement can easily acquire guidelines and best practices from the broad field of academic and military research on the topic of security. Common bonds. Although it seems intuitive that a common cause and common ideology will be the determining factors that draw new members into an underground organization, research shows that people may join the same movement for a variety of motives, and this disparity can serve to undermine the cohesion and security of the organization. See the second edition of Human Factors Considerations of Undergrounds in Insurgencies. As such, a common bond, religious, ethnic, tribal, etc., often provides a much more resilient contribution to organizational unity and security. The Revolutionary United Front, RUF, in Sierra Leone adopted insurgency principles and formal organizational structures that its leadership learned during indoctrination in Libya. Despite this appearance of military structure and discipline, however, the fact remained that the RUF was composed of mercenaries, student radicals, unemployed youth, discharged junior soldiers, and other people whose identity was based on opposition to the system, as well as self-preservation. In this regard, it was no surprise that internal power struggles emerged almost immediately within the RUF leadership structure, to include two significant events in 1993. The first event involved the execution of the RUF second-in-command and 40 other RUF members by other top RUF leaders due to personal rivalries. The second event was the torture and execution of 25 members of the RUF's 1st Battalion, who were mostly ethnic Temne from northern Sierra Leone, by RUF leaders and rebels who were ethnic Mende from southern Sierra Leone, and who wanted to shift the leadership structure of the RUF to those of southern ancestry. These internal purges, as well as actual combat losses, eliminated some of the most popular and competent leaders within the movement and decimated the limited military expertise of the RUF during the early years of the conflict. Similarly, the New People's Army, NPA, in the Philippines conducted numerous purges of its members, including the Second Great Rectification, during which thousands of members were killed on the basis of the accusation of these members being deep penetration agents. Yet in reality, these purges were an effort by one NPA faction to regain control of the Communist Party of the Philippines NPA from the Autonomous Regional Commission and from larger NPA formations that had recently risen to power. The cohesiveness and security of NPA units depended on comradeship, in other words, trusting your comrade with your life, which suffered greatly because of the purges. Compartmentalization. Compartmentalization is the division of an organization or activity into functional segments or cells to restrict communication between them and prevent knowledge of the identity or activities of other segments except on a need-to-know basis. This security measure minimizes the danger of compromising the organization and is accomplished by limiting contacts between superiors and subordinates to include lateral liaison with leaders in other cells. See Chapter 1, Leadership and Organization. Thus, if captured, a member cannot expose anyone other than his fellow cell members because the use of code names protects the identity of others of whom he may have heard or met. However, compartmentalization is difficult to maintain because of the early practice of recruiting friends or relatives, members who know other members, and leaders who may also know more than they should about the organization. While it is not possible to completely eliminate this situation, issuing orders warning against inquisitiveness by average members or indiscretions on their part will help to lessen the danger and reduce the proliferation of information. This was the approach taken by the Sendero Luminoso, a socialist insurgency in Peru, which implemented a cellular tactical structure, with each cell generally composed of 10 or fewer personnel. Only the leader of that cell knew other members outside of that cell, and then only by aliases. Identities of members were carefully protected, and all official communication between cells was conducted by the cell's commander. This process of limiting contact between cells was known as regulated liaison. However, when the Peruvian security forces began to target the cellular structure of the Sendero Luminoso organization, they were able to destroy the effectiveness of an entire cell, and often more, simply by focusing on the leadership, not the individual members. Because none of the other members of a cell had any contact with other cells, their effectiveness was generally gone when their leader was gone. Use of couriers. With the advent of cellular communications and the heavy use of email for daily communications, underground movements began to fall victim to the advanced electronic surveillance capabilities of security forces that targeted these electronic communications. In response, these undergrounds reverted to their older, traditional reliance on couriers and became more disciplined with their use of brevity codes and aliases. Aware of U.S. communication interception capabilities, the Taliban began using messengers as their primary means of communication. This decision reflected the traditional Afghan practice of making sure a planned operation remained secure. In addition to traditional messengers, the Taliban also communicated using written communication, pamphlets, underground newspapers, and communal messages, as well as night letters. These night letters were not only used between Taliban members, but also between the Taliban and non-Taliban Afghans. In the case of Taliban to non-Taliban usage, the night letters often contained death threats to anyone who dealt with foreigners and served as a way to maintain control of the public. Given the Taliban's goal to revert Afghanistan back to the times of the Prophet Muhammad, the Taliban favored this slow form of communication over the internet and mobile phones, which were also more susceptible to interception. In fact, because the Taliban were weary of civilian informants, they even banned cell phone usage because cell phones were a means for private citizens to call in tips on the Taliban's plans. As a result, in March 2008, the Taliban ordered that cell phone companies in Kandahar suspend service from 5 in the evening to 7 in the morning so that the Taliban could operate safely during those hours. The use of a courier, however, does not always guarantee the security of insurgency members. In the case of the largest manhunt in U.S. military history, the personal courier of Osama bin Laden became the only real breadcrumb in the lost trail that eventually led to bin Laden's hideout in Abbottabad, Pakistan. Like the Taliban and other insurgent movements, the leadership of al-Qaeda was acutely aware of U.S. electronic surveillance capabilities and experienced numerous close calls, as well as successful strikes by American forces using cell phones to locate targets. Bin Laden therefore severed his direct electronic ties to the outside world and relied on a very tight, trusted inner circle to facilitate his communications, to include a dedicated courier. The identity of this courier, Abu Ahmed al-Kuwaiti, was confirmed by U.S. Central Intelligence Agency analysts in August 2010 after years of trying to determine this link between bin Laden and the outside world. The analysts determined that al-Kuwaiti drove a white sport utility vehicle that had a graphic of a white rhino emblazoned on its spare tire cover and began tracking the vehicle with satellite imagery. it was soon determined that this vehicle and its driver spent a large amount of time at a large concrete compound in Abbottabad. Screening of new members. Undergrounds exercise caution when inducting new recruits in order to protect against infiltration by counterinsurgency penetration agents. Recruits, therefore, are not fully accepted until a check can be made of their backgrounds, including political activities, jobs, and close associates. Moreover, once accepted, most undergrounds require recruits to undergo a probationary period as a further precaution. Prospective recruits identified as enemy agents are often eliminated. Others whose backgrounds do not clearly indicate their reliability are shunned. In cases in which an individual is needed before a background investigation can be concluded, the recruit will be prohibited from coming into close personal contact with cell members until they have been fully cleared. This is usually done by restricting their contact to one member and at places other than the cell's usual meeting places. When the British increased their use of informants and undercover agents within the Provisional Irish Republican Army, PIRA, the PIRA mounted counter-operations against the Intelligence Network and Reconnaissance Force by raiding a massage parlor, ice cream shop, and laundromat that were run by the British operation and effectively shut down that part of the British network. Loyalty checks and oath. Undergrounds often administer loyalty oaths to new members in order to emphasize the seriousness of the movement and the requirement for them to be completely devoted to the movement. If religion is a critical aspect of daily life in that country, the loyalty oath may also integrate key religious references in order to elevate the authority of the loyalty oath and increase the sense of obligation and commitment that the applicant has toward the movement. It is not unusual for recruits to be warned that any betrayal of the movement may be punishable by death. For the Sendero Luminoso in Peru, all recruitment was initiated by current members, and volunteers would be viewed with suspicion. Accordingly, two current Sendero Luminoso, or Shining Path, members had to vouch for the new recruit. During the initial year of a 2 to 3 year training process, recruits engaged in simple non-combat tasks, such as distributing propaganda. They also received classroom instruction on Marxist texts and guerrilla warfare, as well as indoctrination in Sendero's ideology. After 1 or 2 years, recruits began their military training, which included participation in acts of sabotage, such as destroying high tension towers, bridges, and other infrastructure. Recruits also engaged in physical conditioning and training in small arms use, explosives, combat triage, and other specialized guerrilla warfare proficiencies. At the conclusion of the training period, and after a thorough investigation of the candidate's background, particularly personal associations, a formal determination was made as to whether the recruit would be initiated. If the recruit was accepted, they took an oath before 4 regional leaders who were hooded to protect their identity. Even after 2 or 3 years of training, a recruit would still only possess very limited knowledge of the organizational structure, having only had contact during that time with a handful of other members, because the training cadre used a cell-like structure. Communication security. As mentioned earlier, communication security is a fundamental security policy for underground networks. Code words are used to designate places, movements, and operational plans. Code words are also used as a means of recognition between members meeting for the first time or to indicate danger. Use of unsecure communications, such as email and cell phones, is limited, and as much as possible, couriers are used to transfer information, funds, and other assets between cells. Modern communications and the then-emerging interconnectivity provided by the Internet played a fundamental role in almost every aspect of the formation of the Ustria Trimitare e Kosovës, Kosovo Liberation Army, or KLA. With cellular telecommunications and increased speed of data transmission, it was possible to control certain aspects of the organization from external and non-coerced areas. The use of unsecured cell phones and personal mobile radios was the primary form of communication for intra-unit purposes, as well as for external sources reaching into Kosovo proper. During the onset of the major stages in the conflict in 1998, the primary methods for military coordination were the use of unsecure commercial cell phones, faxes, and face-to-face encounters. every KLA leader assumed that his or her cell phone was being tapped by Serb intelligence services, so all discussions and exchanges were kept to an absolute minimum and strict adherence to operational security was entailed. Places, names, and specific observables were not mentioned because it was expected that operational plans could be easily interpreted by the Serbs. Even during Sierra Leone's civil war, which was known more for its basic brutality than for any advanced usage of communications, let alone communication security, the RUF received training and operational support from some South African mercenaries, and this assistance led to the use of the old British Slidex encryption code for important internal communications. Record keeping. Although record keeping is necessary for any organization, whether clandestine or not, it is important that written records be kept to an absolute minimum in an underground. Only information that cannot be memorized or information that is needed for future reference should be put down in writing to avoid exploitation by the counterinsurgency forces. A worst-case example of what can happen to movements that choose to maintain extensive written records is the case of a World War II French resistance network called the Cartel, which was sponsored by the British Special Operations Executive, SOE. André Girard, leader of the Cartel, and some of his colleagues drew up lists of the Cartel's membership. This list contained paragraphs of personal description, names, addresses, appearances, telephone numbers, experiences, specialties, capabilities, discretions, and so on. All this information was written in the clear, in other words, not encoded, and was kept in Girard's office or study. In November 1942, more than 200 of the most important cards were being taken by a courier from Marseille to Paris by train. During the trip, the courier fell asleep. When he awoke, the briefcase with all the cards was gone. It had been taken by a German intelligence agent. The downfall of the Cartel was therefore assured. A more recent example includes the ability of U.S. counterterrorism officials to gain access to laptops and hard drives belonging to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Osama bin Laden, which have also provided a treasure trove of information on Al-Qaeda and its operations. Underground discipline. Obedience to security rules and procedures is a critical requirement for the survival of an underground. Members are often required to report all violations and may be subject to disciplinary action if they fail to do so. In this regard, the ethics and professionalism of the membership can play a large role in the organization's discipline. Those underground movements that gravitate toward criminal activities to fund the movement, or in some cases, those movements in which criminal activity becomes a target of opportunity for certain members, may see the dedication and discipline of its members deteriorate as they become involved in narcotics, arms, diamond, and other illicit trafficking. Other movements may initially start off with high standards for membership, but then slowly relax those standards and lose discipline as the movement grows and the need for new members grows while the available pool of quality recruits dwindles. To promote discipline and underscore the importance of security to the movement, some undergrounds execute members for serious or frequent breaches, and traitors are also usually executed to discourage others from betrayal. Finally, some of the more ruthless undergrounds will impose heavy tolls on the local population that supports them if it is perceived that there are people in the population who are collaborating with security forces. Examples are plentiful and include the December 2006 execution of 26 men in a Taliban-dominated village west of Kandahar City because these men were accused by the Taliban of cooperating with International Security Assistance Force troops. As an added measure, the Taliban publicly displayed the headless bodies to warn locals that they would face a similar fate if they collaborated with the coalition or government forces. Personal security measures. At the individual level, a basic requirement and skill of an underground member is to blend into his or her surroundings. The member must establish a normal routine that is consistent with the routine of his or her neighbors in order to avoid attracting attention. A former leader in an anti-Nazi underground movement in Germany stated that, quote, "You can't hide from the scientific surveillance of a modern police state, but you can mislead the police. And the best way to mislead them is to live as conventionally and as openly as possible. The more you resemble a normal, everyday citizen in every respect, the less apt you are to be suspected." Close quotes. This same philosophy served as a basis for Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri and the Egyptian jihadist movement. His obsessive-compulsive attitude, he was detail-oriented, rigidly enforced challenges and passwords, consciously avoided pattern setting, etc., and paranoia, he assumed the group was under surveillance, exhibited caution in recruitment, attempted to avoid large congregations of jihadists, etc., were traits that served him and his colleagues well in avoiding the Egyptian law enforcement and counterintelligence apparatus. An important aspect of personal security is the establishment of random behavior patterns. Normal, even innocent behavior patterns may draw the attention of security forces if the activities are repeated in a noticeable pattern. This repetition may also enable the security forces to anticipate future actions and plans. To prevent this possibility, undergrounds will alter their courier routes, living arrangements, meeting places, mail drops, and day-to-day activities. Safe havens. The robust intelligence-gathering capabilities of modern counterinsurgency forces have elevated the importance of safe havens for the security of underground movements. Recent trends have demonstrated a preference toward ungoverned territories, where there is limited government oversight, and where bribery and corruption carry the day. A striking example of the benefit an underground can achieve with access to a safe haven is shown with the Fuerzas Armadas Revolucionarias de Colombia, Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC. President Andrés Pastrana was elected in 1998 and assumed that pacification, not military confrontation, would drive the FARC to negotiation. Pastrana even ceded an area of the country as a demilitarized zone, allowing de facto control by the FARC, called the Despeje, an area that was the size of Switzerland. The FARC took this opportunity of localized self-rule to increase its legitimacy in the eyes of Colombians and the international community. Ambassadors from various countries were invited to the Despeje to meet with FARC leadership, further supporting the FARC's position as a legitimate governing body. They also used this expansive safe haven to recruit, train, improve capabilities, and establish governing bodies in local communities. Meanwhile, production, processing, and trafficking of coca and cocaine flourished in the region. The FARC was also reported to use territory in Ecuador along Colombia's southern border as a safe haven for training and to support illicit business activities associated with coca production. Finally, Venezuela was alleged to have provided safe haven to insurgent FARC fighters and leadership, supporting training sites, as well as harboring command and control locations. In the Philippines, the NPA established safe havens over time in hundreds of areas where the local populace could be depended on for logistics support, from food to medical supplies to batteries. Sendero Luminoso used the University of San Cristobal de Huemanga and the Ayacucho region for several years as a safe haven, building on the disenfranchised local Indian communities while also recruiting intellectuals from the university to grow a political and military base. Actions in the event of compromise. Despite its best efforts to promote security for the organization, the chance always remains that an individual, a cell, or key leaders of the movement may at some point be compromised by counterinsurgency forces. The ability to rapidly identify and react to this compromise is critical to ensuring the overall security of the movement. An initial indicator of possible compromise can occur when a member has failed to keep an appointment, is not reachable by the cell leader, or has disappeared altogether. Every effort is made to determine whether the member has been captured. If capture is verified, or as in most cases, if contact is not established and capture must be assumed, all members with whom the member was in contact or about whom the member possessed information must be immediately alerted, because it should be assumed that the captured colleague has been forced to talk. Affected members immediately abandon their present identities and living arrangements and move to safe houses until a new identity and dwelling can be arranged. For this purpose, all members should have one or more safe houses known only to them where they can stay, with the types of safe houses varying from the homes of friends, remote rural cottages, or even warehouses. When a member is captured, the underground must find out what led to his compromise. If it is determined that he was betrayed by someone within the movement, the informer should be quickly identified and executed. The underground must also react quickly to the capture of members who possess damaging information that could seriously endanger the movement. Every effort must first be made to free the member using methods such as bribery, threats, or blackmail. If these methods fail, an armed rescue of the captured member may be attempted. When these options are not possible or unsuccessful, the movement may then attempt to kill the member in order to silence him. Actions in the case of capture. As part of the indoctrination process for new members, undergrounds will often expose the recruits to a code of conduct for how they should behave if captured. An example of these rules is found in a 1935 book for German communists living in Prague. Among the tenets listed for personal actions when arrested are the following, as cited in The Underground, ST31-202. As a matter of principle, I do not divulge names, cover names, personal descriptions, addresses, or places through which comrades could be contacted. I never admit my guilt in any offense I am accused of, even if all evidence is against me. When I am told that others have already confessed, I do not believe it, and if others have really confessed, I will call them liars, always denying everything. If I am tortured or beaten, I will let them kill me, torture me to death, rather than betray my organization, my comrades. An additional part of the training for new members is instruction on what to expect if captured, in order to better prepare members for any interrogation techniques they may encounter in prison. Common interrogation and interview techniques include the insertion of a deception agent into the same cell to attempt to gain the confidence of the member and obtain information from him. Another method involves demoralizing a prisoner by using information already known about him or the organization in order to make him believe that he was betrayed, thereby undermining his loyalty. Security forces may also attempt to gain information by exploiting a member's ego by praising his exploits for their daring and asking him how he accomplished those exploits. Another common technique is to promise leniency or amnesty to the member in exchange for information. If these techniques fail to achieve the results desired by the security force, torture may be used. Therefore, most organizations assume that torture will eventually be used, that the captured member will eventually be broken of his will, and that information will be divulged. For this reason, underground training for new members will emphasize that members may likely be broken, but that they must strive to resist divulging information for approximately 48 hours in order to allow sufficient time for impacted members of the movement to be notified and proper security measures taken.